is part two of a three-part podcast series entitled The Nation's Next Submarine and Anti-Submarine Warfare. Today, Cyprus is honored to get a chance to discuss perspectives of two leaders in this field, with a special emphasis on the undersea warfare fight. Admiral retired Jamie Fogo and Vice Admiral retired Bruce Lindsay support Cyprus and Cyprus clients as part of our valued subject matter experts team.
The Tomahawk missile was initially deployed in 1983. It has been a primary conventional strike weapon for the Navy in general and for the SSN and our SSGNs most recently in particular. Bertie, do you still see this weapon being relevant against a peer competitor like China for the next decade?
Well, and John, funny you mentioned the Tomahawk or TLAM. When I was a lieutenant in my first squadron, BS-21, back in 1983 to 1987, that shows you how old I am. My CO made me attend the TLAM school, which was at Point Loma, in order to get my mission commander rating. I didn't understand that at the time, but boy, was he right. He felt it was so important to understand how an S-3 could support the maritime strike mission. So the Tomahawk, to me, epitomizes the get payloads concept that Admiral Bowman laid out is a great example of it. The missile itself is a platform that delivers payloads and has been adapted over the years, over and over and over, to keep up and be relevant. At the same time, the Tomahawk is a payload for submarines and surface ships. And so it's part of what I call the maritime strike ecosystem. And it's a pretty good missile. Tomahawk maritime strike goes for the furthest of our sticks right now at about 1,000 miles and cost us about $1 million each. I don't have the exact, but I'm just roughing these. The naval strike missile goes out about 100 miles and costs about twice as much. And then, of course, we got the SM-6, which goes out 200 miles and costs around $4 million a shot. But that's a multi-shot kind of round where it does anti-air, anti-ballistic missile, anti-surface warfare. So we have this nice basket, if you will, of weapons. And I think that's smart because you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You want to have lots of different eggs, if you will. So as we move further along on this manned, unmanned teaming, autonomy, artificial intelligence in Project Overmatch or Project Convergence of the Army or JADC2 of the Air Force, in that environment, having multiple types of payloads simultaneously or near simultaneously attacking an enemy ship, I think is very desirable. And so, yes, I think Tomahawk still has a vital role to play in sea control and power projection today and into the near future because of its stick length and its price. And I know Admiral Fogo understands how we've used that Tomahawk. I remember when I was first flag officer down at the National Military Command Center, Admiral Winnefeld was running how the first strikes may or may not go into Syria. TLAM was a big player there in those plans. And then, of course, Admiral Fogo's, Jamie's talked about how they were used most recently and that ability to use that from different platforms and then fake out the enemy thinking, hey, they're going to launch from a DDG when up through the water came the Tomahawk. That's a pretty good missile. So I like it. Jamie?
You know, it's something that we could take on as a joint venture with industry is to still keep driving the price down, you know, because it's no surprise that inventory of ordnance is a big deal. It's a big deal for us. We're actually seeing that it's a big deal for the Russians as, you know, they run out of ordnance. And most of the kinds of crisis response and areas of the world we're going to operate in, we're going to need a much bigger inventory. So driving the price down is important. In the middle of Odyssey Dawn, you know, Admiral Locklear was my boss, and he got wind of the fact that some of the bean counters were looking at the usage rate of Tomahawk. That missile can go from 750,000 to higher, you know, closer to 1 million, depending on the variant. And we were encouraged to use other kinds of tools in the inventory. And frankly, that was a good thing because it brought in the Kearsarge and the Harriers. And now we have F-35Bs, but those Harriers have put 500-pound bombs on target, and they're extremely effective also with limits to collateral damage with the smaller warhead. So I think these are all important things to take into consideration, and I agree with you, Bertie.
Thank you both very much. I love hearing sea stories about Admiral Locklear, too. He was my boss at the bullpen way back in the day, and one of my favorite memories of Admiral Locklear was he was the Navy's NASCAR team sponsor. So we got to go to all the races, and he'd come back and tell us war stories about watching the Navy team race. It was great. Bertie, the nation has spent a tremendous amount of time and resources on developing hypersonic missile programs. Do you think these exquisitely powerful, lethal, and tremendously expensive weapons must, can, or even should eventually supplant conventional missiles such as the Tomahawk for covert undersea strike? But the follow-on to that would be, how could industry, in your opinion, help?
Okay, that's a good question. You know, I know the CNO said at a recent U.S. Navy memorial talk on 6 May in 2021 that the Virginia-class submarines give us overmatch. We all agree on this podcast. That's true. And he said Block 5 will have hypersonics to go with the Virginia-class payload. So he's thinking that, and he's a pretty smart guy. As for me, hypersonics, I believe, change the operational environment because they fly so fast and they're so maneuverable. And what this does is that your early warning systems provide a lot less time for the decision maker. And with that in mind, one could say they are a game changer. However, in my almost 40 years in the military, is that I learned that for every game changer, there is a counter that can be developed and will be developed because of it. So developing the counter to hypersonic weapons is where I believe industry can really help us out, in addition to building our hypersonics, which we're doing. So I think a counter is very important. Second, hypersonics are expensive. So therefore, they probably will be used strategically, more in a deterrent role, whether they're conventionally or nuclear loaded. So industry must help us develop our hypersonics so that we can match that deterrent value against China and Russia. And we do need, as Admiral Jamie said there, we need to drive costs down. We cannot continue to have these exquisite weapons that cost us so much. You saw our discussion with Tomahawk and where it fit in with Naval Strike Missile and the others, but we can't have exotics anymore. So as industry does develop hypersonics, and we need to drive that cost down and then also quickly figure out how you counter those. Again, I talked about decision-making, decision-makers, and this gets into artificial intelligence that we talked to, another one of the A's. You have to have artificial intelligence to help those decision makers make faster decisions and get inside the OODA loop of the enemy.
Jamie, shifting track a little bit here. You know, certainly one of the things that the Navy is looking at a lot, and it's been a lot in the open press, is Project Overmatch and the Undersea Constellation. Can you speak to the role of our submarine force in the future fight with regard to these concepts? And do you think there might be a role for the Columbia SSBN, our strategic programs, as well in these arenas?
John, thanks for that. That was a very provocative question that you provided me. And, you know, I had some time to think about it in advance. And I actually changed my mind on the last part of the question. Is Columbia going to be a part of Overmatch? And I was inclined to say no. You know, the role of Columbia, I was a navigator and operations officer on an SSBN during my department head tour. The role is to, you know, euphemistically, we say hide with pride, you know, be the most invulnerable part of the triad, and then be ready to launch, you know, with 100% effectiveness should the, you know, God forbid, the commanding officer ever get an emergency action message and have to launch a nuclear strike against a foe. Nowadays, it's just really, really important with what we're seeing happening with our adversaries, and particularly Vladimir Putin. But, you know, as I thought about Overmatch and the fact that we've got to get inside the enemy's OODA loop, the thing that would make Putin really nervous is not knowing where that third element of the triad is, that it's out there, it's deployed at, you know, all of our boats at a higher level of alert, you know, which is where he's put his forces right now, are out there. And they can't do anything about it. And so I do think that Columbia has an important role in Overmatch, and that's to do the traditional job of a SSBN, but to do it better than any other SSBN in the history of nuclear deterrence, to be the quietest, stealthiest, and most effective platform on the planet. For the current fleet of 50 SSNs, which will be growing to 66, in about 15 years, I think there's a significant role for Overmatch, and particularly for the follow-on SSN-X. And I want to go back to, you know, baseline definitions. I've looked at, you know, some of the talks and speeches that Rear Admiral Doug Small has given, and I know Admiral Small. he describes Overmatch. You know, it's his Manhattan Project, as Hondo Gertz originally stated. And it's the Navy's attempt to create a maritime network of ships, sensors, weapons, and platforms that allow the Navy to connect its operations and give commanders broader insight real time. It's not just for the Navy. This is for the Joint Force. Or it has to be a part of our interconnectivity with allies and partners. You know, we talk about the Quad, we talk about AUKUS, and we talk about all our treaty alliances, both in Europe and out in the Pacific. We've got to bring allies and partners in on the link to this network and share data to enhance their field of vision and their common operating picture so that they can contribute to the campaign. So the Pentagon calls this joint all-domain command and control, military-wide concept of operations where everything gets connected through networks that are carrying data from the air, sea, space, and cyberspace. And a human brain can't do that as quickly as artificial intelligence. So that's where AI comes into play, one of Bertie's four aces. And I think that's really important. And I think the hope for the Navy in Overmatch with Admiral Small is that we can link the sensors and the shooters, and the commanders will have more options available to provide them with different options and operations to achieve a much greater impact. And Doug Small's out at NIWC in San Diego. He's got incredible people working for him and incredible technical capabilities at his fingertips. And he says, you know, Overmatch is about connective tissue, providing links and applications for decision advantage. His job is to make sure that those links and tools work across any part of the continuum in the conflict. And it's really interesting. I've heard him say this, the technology will continue to be built no matter what the budget is. So, you know, I've lobbied for more money and breaking the one-third, one-third, one-third paradigm. Admiral Small, here's a quote. If you look at it by any metric, we have a lot of money. And I think what we're trying to do is to go after this with more of an abundance mindset, not a, gosh, I wish I had this much more. You know, what that leads to is what we are starting with and what we have. And that's starting with the people we have, the funding we have, and the technical expertise that we have, which is eye-watering. I found that refreshing. It reminded me of Sir Jackie Fisher at the turn of the 20th century, the first Sea Lord in the UK. And they had some budgetary problems there, and that led to the Battle of Jutland. But he said, okay, when the money runs out, it's time to think. Well, Small and his team are doing some pretty good headwork right now with the resources that they have. And, you know, frankly, I'm proud of them. Now, let me just give you my take on Overmatch. This is there's another important aspect of this, and it's called, or it's known as decision advantage. And first of all, you have to have the platform. And this is nothing new. I mean, I've said this before, but, you know, 22 years ago, Vice Admiral Art Zabrowski came from the Naval War College where he was president. He was promoted, brought down to net assessments by Donald Rumsfeld, and asked to put this transformational network-centric warfare idea into play. And it was about the platform. So, you know, what did I just say about Admiral Small? Getting the platform, getting everybody on board. Zabrowski said this in 2000. And the goal was to get inside the enemy's OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, and act. Zabrowski's view of network-centric warfare was that with near perfect situational awareness, that's pretty tough to get there. It would be possible for blue forces to know what the enemy might not know and make decisions to interdict the enemy's forces. Moreover, to interdict or neutralize the enemy's forces before the enemy even knows that the blue force has done that. So as far as the enemy is concerned, think of the scenario like this. Things are clicking along. Nothing's unusual. We're in a hot, you know, kinetic war. And then all of a sudden reports come in that the enemy's forces have been geolocated, targeted, and destroyed without our enemy even knowing that those forces were at risk. That is decision advantage, in my humble opinion. Now, you guys have all, you all know Admiral Jim Stavridis. He was my boss. You've read his books. You know about the accidental admiral. There was no accident. Jim made admiral. He's brilliant. But let me borrow a play from his playbook and tell you the story of accidental decision advantage during the Syrian chemical weapons facility strikes in April 2014 that both Bertie and I have alluded to. You know, so I was a supporting commander for the strikes conducted by CENTCOM, but delegated to, you know, the JFMC Admiral Aquilino as COM 5th Fleet. He was the supported commander. The strikes were conducted from both the Arabian Gulf and the Eastern Med. as my French counterparts would say, from tout ça s'y moot, all bearings. President Trump made no bones about the fact that he was going to punish Assad for using chemical weapons against his own people, something we call genocide. Although we would conduct the strikes at the time and place of our choosing. But it was no secret to either Assad, the Syrians, and the Russians who were hosted in his country helping him fight in this war that this was going to happen. So the Russians pushed out about 30 ships to sea from, you know, Latakia and Tartus in Syria. And we had DDGs from our forward deployed naval base in Rota running around out there too. So if you're a Russian warship at sea and you think that, you know, strikes are coming and that the favorite weapon of the Americans is Tomahawk, they have caliber, which is very similar, then you're naturally going to go out, if you're on the frigate Gorshkov, and tuck in on the port or starboard quarter of USS Donald Cook and, you know, conduct an indications and warning patrol. Let your boss back in Syria or the Syrian allies that you've allied with know what's coming. That's a pretty uncomfortable feeling for both the American and the Russian CEO, right? As they're running around out there, is this guy going to shoot? And then what are we going to do about it? But when the launch time arrived, those American destroyers were silent in the Eastern Med. Somewhere, unseen, T-LAMs emerged from under the sea from USS John Warner. There was no Russian tail, and the Russians were caught flat-footed. No one saw it coming. There wasn't anything they could do about it. And by not providing indications and warning, the Syrian integrated air and missile defense couldn't do anything about it. The strike's effects were accurate. All targets were destroyed before the Russians or the Syrians even knew where they came from. That's what I call decision advantage. John, back to you.
I've never heard that story before, and that is very inspirational. And what a huge validation of a covert strike from a frontline attack submarine. Jamie, you supported a 1998 study on the next generation of submarines after Virginia, which now we are starting to talk about now with the SSNX, which the Virginia actually used to be called, looking to hit the water in the 2040s. How do you think that your study that you participated in holds up almost a quarter of a century later?
Yeah, John, thank you. It was an incredible experience, actually. I was working at OSD and A&T, Acquisition and Technology, and that office has changed names many times, but it still does the same thing. It's about acquisition and technology. And a great man, he's no longer with us, rest in peace, Dr. Paris Janalis, a Greek Fulbright, educated by Admiral Rickover, worked at the David Taylor Center, designed the propulsion system on Seawolf. Dr. Janalis loved submariners. He always had a guy in his office. I was that guy, and he said to me, hey, we're going to do a Defense Science Board task force on submarines. You'll be the government advisor, which meant that, you know, I made sure the coffee was hot, that everybody had a pen and paper, that meetings started on time, and it was like herding cats. But it was, you know, it was really interesting and a heck of a lot of fun. It was headed by Mr. John Stenbitt, who was an aerospace engineer and a vice president, and also somebody who had served in the Pentagon. So it was a really good combination. Don't be put off by the fact that the task force began its work in 1997, produced a report in 1998, because what they were looking at was, you know, 22 years ahead to 2020. What's the next attack submarine look like after Virginia? Virginia wasn't built until 5 years later. The first thing they looked at is that, you know, time-honored question, do we need to go back to diesel boats? And they looked at it hard. And there were proponents to do that, but there wasn't enough evidence to show that it was the right thing to do. So it was discounted and it was decided. And the one phrase I think everybody remembers from this study is that the SSN, the nuclear powered attack submarine, is the crown jewel of our force. Sounds parochial, but, you know, didn't come from me. It came from them. It sounds parochial for me to say it. I'm a submariner, but it came from them. And they were industry people and engineers and academics. You know, the other thing, the terms of reference they used to look at this was, you know, like I said, Virginia's coming along. It's in design, it's in production. We're bending metal, but the first ship wasn't going to be out until 2003, 5 years later. The assumption was it takes 15 years to come up with a design for a new ship. So let's look out 20 years and be ready to build this next attack submarine SSNX by 2020. They first did kind of a future study, right? Let's look at the landscape and see what's going to happen out there. And 10 to 20 and then 50 years. So two chunks of time, you know, 20 years ahead, 50 years ahead. you know, they got this temporally incorrect. So these were conclusions, assumptions and conclusions that were wrong by that DSB study. And it's really interesting because they said in 20 years, so right, pretty much right now, there will be no plausible strategic competitor for the United States of America. How wrong is that? We got China on the rise and we got Russia, and nobody would have ever thought that Russia was going to do this. I feel a little bit vindicated from my writing of the Fourth Battle of the Atlantic in 2016, because, you know, I didn't think the Russians were going away, nor were they broke, and nor were they a failed state. And look what they've done to Europe and to the country of Ukraine. They said in 50 years, Russia will be back on the stage and China will join the stage. So we didn't have a clue. These are smart people. And this is, you know, defense science board didn't have a clue at the time that China was going to make such a rapid rise. And so I think that's interesting and important. They looked at the Navy's role. How do we see the Navy's role 20 years ahead? They nailed it. Number one, strategic deterrence. Two, protect sea lines of communication. ISR is important. Sea control and power projection, mine countermeasures, and self-protection against ASW and ASUW. You think about the things we talked about, the enemy outsticking us, the enemy producing massive quantities of ships, including submarines, both hybrid diesels and nuclear submarines. These are all correct conclusions from the study. They concluded that with costs going up, we had to figure out how using this crown jewel with a limited number of platforms could be improved. So they directed in the study, need a longer life platform, less maintenance downtime, automation, connectivity to allow remote expertise, you know, so over the horizon, coming through the satellite, telling you how to fix your boat, logistics improvement, innovative manning and crew rotation. We've certainly experimented with a lot of things, particularly with LCS. Is that applicable in the future? Forward staging of critical support and the ability to rearm and resupply forward. You know, what's interesting about that is after the USS John Warner shot those Tomahawk missiles, CNO submariner John Richardson directed, hey, we're going to reload in theater. And everybody kind of looked around and said, okay, they don't have a submarine tender over there, so how are we going to do this? The guy that got the laser dot on his forehead was Vice Admiral Joe Tofalo, and Joe figured it out. And that's really, really important. It's a great lesson for us, because I think if we hadn't had that question come up, that we'd still be sitting here today saying, how are we going to do it? Now we have a plan. You know, by the way, we don't have enough tenders. We got to buy some more. They looked at the attributes of an SSN. This is kind of funny. I loved it. These were just black and white slides back then. The SSN is unique, stealthy, high endurance, mobile, and it's pretty special. It can carry heavy weapons against big surface combatants, conduct covert intelligence, and it can have covert weapons for surprise. I mean, I think about TLAM, what we just talked about. It matches the Navy roles of all those things I talked about: sea control, crisis response, covert strike, ASW, countermine, and forward presence. So, you know, as a government advisor, it was also my job. Dr. Janalis and Dr. Stambit told me, get some people to come in here and talk about, you know, what would constitute the best design for the next attack submarine. Who did I call? I called the Shell Answer Man, my classmate, Willie Hilaritas. Willie and I think we were commanders at the time, and he was working on the Joint Staff J3. And I said, hey, Willie, I need a joint officer to come down here and talk about next generation submarine. He goes, okay, I'll send you my boss, Lieutenant General Mark Hamilton. I said, what is he, Air Force guy? And he goes, no, he's an Army guy. He was in Vietnam. He's great. You're going to love him. General Hamilton was welcome. He came in, you know, big, tall, lean officer, sat down, turned his chair around, took his coat off, rolled up his sleeves. And he told the Defense Science Board, ladies and gents, I don't know anything about submarines, but I'll tell you this. If you're going to build something new and you're trying to come up with a design right now, look what the B-52 did for me in Vietnam. You know, when we got cornered and we had to call in a strike, it was always there. You know, I think they called those arc light missions. It saved his life. And he said, that was 1972. And at the time, this was 1997. And by the way, the B-52 is still flying in 2021. So the general had one line for the Defense Science Board. If you're going to build a submarine, make it like the B-52. Build a big truck and make it mutable. That's payload over platform, right? So the platform is the hull, the payload's what's really important. Final recommendations from the task force: have a design for the next generation SSN by 2020. You know, ask the question, do we need to tweak the propulsion You can ask yourself that question. We can talk about that. Focus on payload and weapons. Maximize time on station. Build the ship with an open architecture, leveraging off dual-use commercial off-the-shelf technology.
Jamie, thank you. You know, certainly you think about a platform that's going to last for 40 or 50 years or even longer, like the B-52 or the carrier. And now we're talking about that way for submarines. Making it open architecture, making a truck is huge. So I'm very much appreciative of that comment, and I do think it's absolutely essential. So that's all we have time for this week. I look forward to continuing the conversation next week, where we're going to dig into aspects of interoperability. We're going to dig into where submarines fit into the undersea warfare theater, and we're going to talk a little bit more about submarine as an apex predator.